the violence or the lunacy. Shootings even at airports now. You might say that we're in an endangered species. Human beings.
You want to bug us, then we have to lock you up.
I was examined thoroughly. Then, since everything about me, you put it into the computer, and then created this model of my mind.
Yes! Through that model, they managed to generate every thought I could possibly have.
She knows everything I'm ever going to do before I know it myself.
Why must you needlessly complicate? Why must you needlessly complicate everything?
Now you see that evil will always triumph, because good is dumb.
You are listening to Cloak and Dagger on Mojo Radio. My name is Too Deep. You can call me Deep. You can call me Deep Throat, but I am Too Deep. I'm in Too Deep. And we'll have Bob Dobbs on the line in just a moment. In the meantime, Lenny Bloom, what's been happening this week?
Well, what's happening is, once again, Cloak and Dagger is a show for spies. And it's a show for spies because we present a panoptical purview of political progress and the future presentation of the past, where the possible was the improbable, and the improbable is the inevitable.
Wow.
And that's what we're doing.
Wow.
And we use spies from all around the world. We use Bob Dobbs. We use everybody that's available who are in the intelligence business and know how to gather.
Well, I think Bob Dobbs is beyond just a spy.
Bob,
I think,
here?
I think Bob is with us now. Bob.
Guys, I'm here.
Okay, welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you. Welcome
what happened
yourself.
There in cyberspace?
Beg your pardon?
What happened in cyberspace?
Oh, you know, enemies.
Enemies.
Vatican agents, British intelligence, Nazis, Bolsheviks, Android meme, they're all together working now. There's no separate faculty.
Well, we appreciate your multi-leveled approach to analyzing the information flow and overload, Bob.
Yes.
Are you there or did we lose you?
Well, what do you make of that silence?
That silence was not exactly a question geared at a response. It was a statement. And Bob Dobbs, I would like to know how your week was. What has been happening? What have you plugged into in the last little while?
Dig the silence. Dig the silence.
Okay, so you're silencing out on us, are you? Well, let's explain and fill the silence in with a little bit of information about tonight's show. In hour one is what Bob... Dobbs and Bloom or Bloom and Dobbs? Which hour are you going to call it?
Well, let's do Dobbs and Bloom first.
We're going to have Greg Palast is on the show, and all of those who want to know about him, it's gregpalast.com. And then we're going to have Video Dave do a review of Ammo for the Information Warrior.
Ralph Nader, very, very great man.
Exactly. And in hour two, we're going to bring in, after a discussion with Bob and I about what's going on, we're going to talk with Eric Phelps. And at the last minute, Eric called up, and there's some new information in that secret society, which we're going to talk about in the second hour.
There you go. Now, Lenny, can you tell me about what you were saying earlier? You have something, some international news.
Yeah, I think we should announce a little bit about, go back to the Philippine desk, because what happens in the Philippine desk is interesting in light of where we're at with American culture and listening to CNN, or what I call it DNN, which is Distraction Network News. And the Philippine desk is a great example of DNN, because what's happening in the Philippines now is that the elected leader, the duly elected leader, was originally, as we reported a few weeks ago, actually at the beginning when we started in the summer, we reported that he had been put in jail and there were trumped up charges, or charges that appeared to be not viable or true sources. It was trumped up is what the allegations, because everybody believed that. Now those charges have been dropped, but he's still in jail. And he's being kept there by Gloria Arroyo, who's an American puppet. So while the United States is talking about freedom and democracy and spreading all this good cheer, in the Philippines that isn't quite happening. So that's really of interest, and we wanted to get that Philippine desk material out to everybody out there, all our spies out there.
Any comments, Bob?
Well, as Lenny would say, what else is new?
Good stuff, exactly.
People are always being naughty out there. There's always somebody. You know, people hear about these movies and they wonder, you know, are people really that bad? The supervillains you see in movies, yes, they are based on real people.
Well, that's the issue there, Deep Throat. There are no real people, and there are no people. I wish people would understand it.
Please, tell us, Bob. Tell us.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, what I did, did you see the mistake I made? I said there are no people, but I wish people would understand that. I leave you with the paradox. The Android meme is a great simulation of us. It is running the show, and we understand that. That's why we sit back and laugh at it.
Well, the other day, Terminator 2 was on again, Bob, and I'm just wondering if that has any, it draws some parallel between that movie and what you're saying about the Android meme.
The Android meme has no content. If you actually look at the situation we're in, millions of data transmitted everywhere constantly, none of it can stop and be focused on. There is no content. So any movie, any book, any show does not deal with the situation. You have to understand how we have literally disappeared, and communication has disappeared. That's what we're up against.
And so the content has disappeared. So who are we the content?
Not anymore. There is no content. There's no form.
The user is not the content anymore?
I don't want to sound like a Manichaean, but we've reached that Gnostic point of total illusion. Now, this has been man-made, human-made, but we can't stop it. So we're stuck with it. And I suggest that any problems that have come up over the past year, like September 11th, were panic reactions to having disappeared.
Ah, okay. Well, that's an interesting one. That's getting waxing very heavy, though, tonight.
Oh, not heavy, because there's no weight. There's no ground. There's no content. It's very hard to believe, but that is actually what we're up against. And any event, any search, any plot, any spy, any quest will lead to that fact that there is no information.
No information and no people.
No. Oh. Information. You got to say it like that.
Welcome to the show, Greg. And for everybody who's on the internet, I'm sure you've already seen the link to GregPalast.com, his website, and you're familiar with how he's an investigative reporter and exposes truth about globalization and corporate cons and high finance fraudsters. You must have been really busy.
Yeah, well, actually...
Tell us about it.
I got to tell you, it's very hard to get these stories in the press. You know, I mean, I've been screaming about Enron. I won an award in Britain for going undercover. I actually went undercover and uncovered how Enron was buying up the British government in 1998. So that's like 4 years ago. And, you know, you couldn't get this in the U.S.-Canadian press. You got guys like Enron's chief, Ken Lay, who are supposed to be some cross between Elvis and Jesus there. So, you know, it was, like, impossible. So,
yeah,
so it's very difficult. For those that don't know me, I report for the BBC Television and write for the Guardian Papers of Britain. And the CBC, believe it or not, allowed me on.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. I'm happy.
Yeah, that's terrific.
Once in a while. We'll see. There's certain things I'm not allowed to say, so let's save them tonight.
Well, we're a show for spies, and we're a show that recognizes that much of the world's invisible, and the invisible government and Big Brother are making things difficult to get into the press. Why don't you go through some of the things that are falling through the cracks that you want to start with, Greg?
I want to talk to you about your Canadian luminaries.
Terrific. Let's go into it.
Okay, here you go. How many of you know that Daddy Bush, George Bush Sr., left the White House to go work for a Canadian gold mining company after he left the White House to sell his Rolodex and his influence with dictators to a Toronto citizen, if you call him that, named Peter Monk?
Ooh,
and
Monk yes.
is one of your richest men in your fair town of Toronto. He owns a company called Barrick Gold Mining, which he started with the great Canadian, Adnan Khashoggi, the arms dealer, the guy who was the bag man, the Iran-Contra scandal.
Hey, Saudi!
Now, I called Barrick a couple weeks ago, and I said, well, when did Khashoggi disengage from your company? He said, he was never with us, except it's in Monk's biography. You know, it's like he's very proud that he got the money out of this shake. He shook down the shake, which is pretty hard to do. Especially a guy with guns like that. So he shook down the shake, started this business, a failed oil company, became a gold mining company. And the first thing that they did was that they bought a gold mine operation in the USA, Nevada, the biggest gold mine in America. And it wasn't worth much, but then they were able to get Daddy Bush's administration to change the rules in America, the procedures in America, so they could seize the claim, the ownership of the gold, $10 billion worth of gold, for which they paid the United States Treasury. They've laid a claim, you know, like little prospectors laying a claim. Laid a claim. They paid the U.S. Treasury less than $10,000, got $10 billion worth of gold for. Now, so that's a nice little deal. Now, of course, they had to spend billions to get the ore out and all that stuff. It wasn't like the gold bars jumped out, but just about. And that's just the beginning of the story. Then Daddy Bush wrote letters to the dictator Suharto for them, and that didn't pan out. But then they went to Tanzania, and here's the hard, nasty part of the story. There was another Canadian company, another one of your great Canadian citizens, corporate citizens, named Sutton Resources. Sutton Resources owned a gold concession in Tanzania, which is in East Africa. But unfortunately, there were already Tanzanians on the property, so they couldn't mine the gold with their big industrial equipment. So they decided to get rid of the Tanzanians on the property, and on the first week of August, 1996, Sutton Resources bulldozers rolled across the property, military police of Tanzania behind them, in the middle of the night, rolled across the property, smashed down all the workers' equipment, smashed their houses to bits, chased them off the property, shot at them, and unfortunately, in the middle of the chaos, they filled in all the miners' little pits. There were 50 miners still inside those mine shafts, and almost all of them were buried alive. I say almost all of them because I have the sworn statement of one of the survivors who took 4 days to dig his way out. 50 miners buried alive by Sutton Resources, a Canadian company. Now, in the middle of this, Barrick Gold Mining is in this discussion with this company to buy them. It's only valuable if they can have this property empty to the Tanzanians. Now that it's empty to the Tanzanians, they can close this sale.
Now, Greg, the Baltimore Chronicle has quoted you saying that Greg Palast is investigative journalism at its best. No one has exposed more truth about the Bush cartel and lived to tell the story, unquote.
Oh, I'm not telling you where I'm living, though. You know, this is from, I'm actually calling you from
the
location
moon.
Unidentified. Like I said, I go undercover. It's, by the way, your dear company, Barrick, chases me all over the planet with their lawyers. They are on a constant harassment campaign. Real nice guys. You know Maude Barlow, the head of Council of Canadians?
Yes.
She's been trying to get this word out about these killings in Tanzania. But Barrick has been bullying. You know, you've got a paper, it's so-called, called the Globe and Mail, something like that. They're going to put this story on the front page. Then one of their top boys called down to the editor and said, "No, you don't." They were going to have their best reporter on it, Mark McKinnon. He was pulled. He already was in Africa, and they made him get on a plane and come home. So that's your news. You are.
Right.
I mean, in America we are censored. In Canada you are censored. So we can hold hands together.
That's right. We get to say what your government.
DNN. This is DNN.
All right.
Greg, how does former Prime Minister Mulroney fit into this? What do you mean? How does he fit in? He takes the money. Mulroney picked up is the guy that brought Bush into the con. Okay? And for doing so, Mulroney picked up 500,000 share options in Barrick. Now, I don't know how many million Canadian that works out to, but I can tell you it's several million Canadian just for using the good names of your government and for bringing in Bush and his dictator contacts. Now, remember, like one of the things that he did was contact the dictator Suharto to give them a gold mining concession in Indonesia, and the dictator said okay. So he stole the gold mining concession away from the guy that discovered the gold mine, gave it to Peter Munk and Mulroney and Bush and their outfit. Then it turned out that the word is that there was some bribery going on from Barrick, but from a different company in the U.S., who then seized the property away from Barrick, and they got very lucky, Mulroney and gang, because it turned out that the gold mine was a complete con. So the American company invited the geologist that found this fake gold for a discussion about his fake find, and unfortunately the geologist fell out of a helicopter on his way to meeting with the corporate chiefs. Happens, you know.
You know, if you hear a silence here, it's because we're all seeing our jobs disappear.
Was
you know,
that, was
it's
that, was
quite
that
dangerous.
In Texas? Where did that take place?
Well, that took place in Indonesia. A guy named Mike de Guzman was the
right,
the con man who. What he did was a geologist who stuck some gold nuggets in his pocket and said, "Eureka, I found the biggest gold mine in the world."
Now,
yeah, and he didn't. He found, you know, he conned these guys, and unfortunately took a short trip off a helicopter that hadn't landed yet.
Yeah, that got reported here, of course.
Yeah.
Go on to quickly something that I wanted to take out of your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy.
Yep. You can take it out of my book.
Yeah, and talk about it. I quote you here, and you say, here's how your president was elected. In the year leading up to the presidential election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush removed tens of thousands of citizens from the voter rolls. Harris claimed they were felons, but almost none were, though 54% were guilty of being African American, unquote.
Yeah, they ran what the U.S. used to call a Jim Crow election. It was what they did was is that they knocked off. By the way, I just found out from the company that did the evil deed for them got $4 million payout.
$4 million.
$4 million. A company called Database Technologies, part of a little operation called Choice Point. Another guy to look out for. We talk about cloak and dagger. Anyway, if you made up a list of people who supposedly committed crimes,
right,
in Florida, they weren't allowed to vote in Florida. Because they're evil, terrible people. Turned out it was 94,000 people.
Yeah.
Turns out that 91,000 minimum of those 94,000 were innocent, but most of them were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, what they did was they knocked out nearly 100,000 Democratic voters. And you know, we're talking, you know, everyone, the Chads and all that stuff back in between Gore and Bush,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it came down, by the way, to the official count was 357 votes for George Bush that made him president, and they knocked out tens of thousands of Democratic voters. This story was not covered in the U.S. until, I have to say, the Washington Post finally ran my story 7 months after I discovered the story. I did put it in The Guardian, in the British papers, on BBC. You couldn't get this in America. It's unpatriotic to say there is no democracy in America. We had a coup d'etat.
Right.
Engineered by Jeb Bush, the brother of the candidate.
And we have some phone calls. Let's go to John in Mississauga. You have a question for Greg Blast.
Yes, Greg. I was wondering, can you tell me anything about the other Bush son, Mr. Neil Bush? I remember his name coming up something more recent in the news, but I do remember it being prominent in what happened. It was kind of the Enron of its day in 1987. It was called the Savings and Loan Scandal. And all that money that was there
Silverado. I mean, anybody would put their name in a bank called Silverado, you know, named after a major gold heist or something. It's like, you know, come on. It's not like they didn't signal their punch. Neil ran off of the bank. He siphoned, he and his buddy took the money out of the bank, and then the U.S. government had to bail them out. The daddy and who was vice president at the time, took care of him. So, you know, that's a typical problem with the Bush family, not knowing where policy ends and their personal piggy bank begins. We also had Neil mucking around in Argentina, which is a mess, and he's part of that mess.
Is that the Argentina water situation?
No, for example, there's several things. So we have Neil Bush messing around with oil companies, Daddy Bush, Bush Sr. trying to help Mirage Casinos get a casino in Buenos Aires. Which was because he's really close to Menem. Now, here's the interesting thing. We do know that there was a pipeline that was running between Chile and Argentina, gas pipeline. According to the public works minister, who I just interviewed on tape for BBC television, he says he got a call from one of the sons of the vice president at the time in 88, who had just been elected president, the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, saying, listen, do me a favor. We want you to give that pipeline. My daddy would appreciate giving that pipeline to a company called Enron. And the guy was mainly surprised because the offer from Enron, as far as he's concerned, was completely corrupt. It was trying to steal the pipeline for nothing with the understanding that he, as a minister, would be able to, put a little cash away into his bank account. So now here's the question, which brother is it? The minister knows Neil, so he knew it couldn't be Neil.
Was it George then?
So he thought it was George W. because the guy said, I just got done campaigning. Well, guess what? I'm now hearing from inside the industry, from people who are familiar with the situation, that was some of the people didn't expect, which is first brother Jeb, It was Jeb who made the fix-it call for Enron. So what BDC has done, now I'm waiting for Jeb to get back to me. I've sent him a note saying, listen, you've been accused, yes or no, true or false. Just let me know. You know, if it's false, tell me. But, you know, suddenly it's like I'm getting the silent treatment from Jeb. He's usually a guy with a big mouth.
Well, do you expect him to answer you? Or
I would expect him to answer. Well, let's put it this way. When the answer is no, they get right back to you when they say, it's not me. Now, George W. said it wasn't him. But that struck me as kind of, you know, it's like, well, you know, it's kind of like implying maybe it's one of my brothers. It's kind of the Menendez brothers' defense is what the Bush brothers are used to, you know. They,
yeah.
have all these. So you have Neil, you have Marvin. Don't forget Marvin. He's another piece of work. He was running around Saudi Arabia and Yemen trying to sell water pipelines for Enron after the Gulf War. Norman Schwarzkopf, you know, who was like the big hero of the Gulf War, he was ready to lose his lunch finding out that he goes sends all these boys into the desert to get, you know, shot at by Scud missiles. They win a war, and the next thing you know, you got the Bush boys in there, Neil and Marvin, you know, with their suitcases full of Enron trinkets to give to the natives. And, you know, it's like, this family is, like, very special. Yeah, so you got Neil. Neil just won. Don't forget Marvin. Don't forget Jebby. And obviously W.
And Bush 43.
Yeah. So.
Sounds like a football signal code.
Yeah. Great. Maybe you could go, I don't have time in this segment, can you go into the Fon Foulet Sugar Brothers situation? I don't think the
Before we do, Bob, I just want to say everybody can sort of see and hear what's happening on mojoradio.com, www.mojoradio.com, and get in there and see the studio and hear the show. And
also links to the site.
Links to the site.
Palace and everything else, because I tell you, Greg, this is going very well, but boy, we have a lot of homework. I've got to go look up four bushes now. This is great.
Yeah, they just multiply, you know.
Great. Could you tell us about the Fon Foulet brothers, the sugar in Florida?
The Fon Hul brothers.
Fon Hul?
It is, yeah. These are the sugar barons of Florida. This is, okay, I won't make it complicated. It's another Jeb Bush special. What happened is that these sugar plantations are dumping phosphorus into the Everglades. You know, I mean, you may not love a swamp. I went there and got, like eaten alive by mosquitoes. But, you know, you do want to preserve one of the last great swamps of America besides Washington. And so they've been dumping phosphorus in there. But the Fon Hul brothers, who are the big owners of the plantations, they're also the big donors. First of all, to the Democratic Party, too, not just the Republicans, but real big time to Republicans. And so, even though Florida law says to clean up that mess, Bush is trying to come up with a scheme so his big donors don't have to clean up their own mess. So a company named Azurix came in and said, listen, we'll tell you what, we'll clean up the phosphorus, but you give us the water from the Everglades and we'll sell it to the 6 million people of South Florida. And we'll start selling off the water, the clean water from the swamps. This scheme, it turns out, now this scheme is completely crack brain. It would have involved, you know, setting up reservoirs all over the state. It was a complete berserker move, and it would have cost the public a fortune to buy water, because they'd have to buy all this swamp water to be cleaned up. And it turns out Azurix is 100% owned subsidiary of Enron Corporation, which is the number one, until it collapsed, of course, it was the number one lifetime supporter for George W. Bush's political career and big-time supporter for Jeb Bush as well. So the Bush family said, we'll take care of our sugar daddies, the sugar plantation barons, so they don't have to clean up their mess, by enriching our other buddies at Enron and handing over the water system of Florida to them to charge people through the teeth. By the way, the Enron Water Company had taken over the Buenos Aires Water Company. We were back down in Argentina. They destroyed the whole thing, and even the Argentines, who have to put up with a lot these days, they kicked out Enron. They said enough of these guys. So they kicked them out of Buenos Aires. They sent them to Florida. You know, so there you go. So that's another Bush story. Take it, Weaver.
Well, that's a great story. I'm sure that's new.
it's a new story, but it's an old trick.
Have you reported that on the BBC?
No, well, actually, don't. BBC's going to be very happy. So will CBC, because I think I'm going to report it. Don't tell CBC I already told you the story.
Oh, people from CBC listen to this show, everybody.
No, they've gone to sleep by now.
They're in bed.
Yeah, they're a distraction news network. They've gone to sleep. And Mansbridge,
don't tell him.
No, he doesn't listen to the real news. He can't.
Greg Palast, we had someone call who couldn't stay with us. They were calling from a cell phone, and it was cutting out. But they did ask if you could elaborate on the coup that you allege has happened in the U.S. and how, you know, to explain a little further how Bush actually didn't win that election. And the whole thing is a farce.
Yeah, well, what happened was, I call it a coup by computer, because they literally they generated a list using computer databases, a fake list, saying people were criminals. And in Florida, in most of the United States, if you served your time, gone to prison, all that, you don't lose your citizenship. Florida's unusual. But whatever, that's the law of Florida. The main thing is that they accused tens of thousands of people of being criminals who weren't. But they weren't just any old people. They happened to be almost just overwhelmingly a list of Democrats. We know that because you're registered by party. And they also know that half of these people were African-American or Hispanic. We know that in Florida because, believe it or not, in Florida, the race of the voter is actually written on their registration form.
That's amazing.
But it means that computers, that if you are trying to get rid of black voters. Not that the Republicans don't like black voters. They just don't like the color of their vote, which is Democratic. Almost 93% of black people in America vote Democratic. So if you get rid of the African American voters and Hispanic voters, you've flushed out the Democrats. So they got rid of tens of thousands of people. Now they say, by the way, they admit they made what they call a mistake. Well, then if they admit there's a mistake, that means the guy in the White House is a mistake.
And, of course, this is the same strategy as what we're told with the voting machines, that all they did was put the vote counts into negative territory and then set them up and let people pull the handles. And
let me tell you, when
all the slot machines are in.
Let me tell you about the touchscreen voting. There's nothing more dangerous than voting by computer in terms of manipulation. And one of the problems, and it's not so much that they change your vote if you vote for a Republican or a Democrat, they change it to Republican. What they do is that they screw up the machine so you can't get your vote counted in certain districts. Now, what happened in Miami in the Democratic primary, when the whole thing went kablooey with the computer voting, those computers were put in place, they were approved by then-Secretary of State Catherine Harris, the woman who was behind the manipulation of the vote count. But what people don't know is that there's another lady behind that. Before Catherine Harris, there was a woman named Sandra Morfam. I'm not making up this name, Morfam, right? Her name is Sandra Morfam, and she is the lobbyist for the company that created these goofed-up voting machines. It turns out she's the woman who actually created this illegal purge of black voters before the presidential election. In other words, she's back. She's a Republican hack functionary whose main job in life seems to be election screwing up. But it always screws up in favor of the Republicans, and that's a very interesting little turn.
Yes, I've heard Greg before, and I have in my notes, I'm not sure what it refers to, but Jeb and the post-Enron $2 million. What does that trigger off in you, Greg?
Oh, God, the guy's a piece of work. Enron collapsed, and 45 days later, and you have to understand, the pension fund of Florida invested $300 million in Enron stock, you know, which is like, you know, might as well have gone to Vegas and you know, put on the roulette wheel, they would have done better. They put $300 million. No other state dreamed of putting in that much money into Enron. Jeb put that money into Enron. The company collapses. The state of Florida is looking for assets to recover for its retirees. So they sue Enron. They're suing its officers. They're trying to recover all the money. Jeb Bush flies to the home of the president, the ex-president of Enron, does a fundraiser, and from Enron buddies, the Enron crowd, raises $2 million and goes back to Florida. So he found the assets. He just took them home. You know, so, I mean, you know, it's like there is no shame. 45 days after the company goes under with his state retirement fund.
It was unbelievable.
That's that pause. That last thing you heard was disgust.
Well, you know, the thing is, I used to do racketeering cases for the U.S. government. And the rule was ill-gotten gain is recoverable. The Bush family campaign kitty is probably, there's a big hunk of that which is involved with basically these various racketeering activities of which there have been now several indictments. I'm not quite sure. Frankly, the federal government should be seizing parts of the Republican campaign war chest. It's just what you automatically do in racketeering cases.
All right. We have Linda from Mississauga on the line. Linda, you have a question for our guest.
Yes, hello, I do. I would like to know more Canadian content, if Greg could fill in on that.
So more about Maersk Gold?
Yes, and other wonderful politicians we have up here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I find Canada very interesting because it like you like to pride yourself on being cleaner than the U.S. You just, it's a little more, it's a different style, but they're still grabbing with both hands. And one of the things that you really have to watch out for, by the way, if you want to talk about easy squeezy and politicians up on the auction block, is this whole game towards privatization of your electric and water system. Look out. That's where you're going to see the big easy squeezy money coming in. So look out for that whole action. So
That odor has actually begun.
That goes back to Toronto Hydro, Ontario Hydro, that is, and the chairman and the way in which Maurice Strong moved through that organization like, you know what, through a goose.
Yes, well, I mean, you have to remember that, but the other thing is, like I was saying, I was looking at the Barrick Gold Mining, which is very interesting because it brings in your whole elite of Canada. It's not just Peter Monk of Toronto and Mulroney. It's the whole gang. What's interesting, when they launched their little international committee with some of your biggest names in Canada, it also included the editors of your two major national papers. I mean, what are they doing getting involved in this stuff? They should be reporting on this stuff. Instead, they're doing their best to cover up the story.
Right, and that's the control over the media and the top-down control that we have and the monopolization and the concentration of ownership into the hands of just one or two people.
Okay, Lenny.
The whole thing. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, what do you use, Greg, do you use Executive Intelligence Review, because in the middle 90s, they were the only one talking about the Barrick-Mulroney overlap with Bush. Are you aware of them as a source of information?
I'm aware of them. I don't use them, actually, because sometimes they go a little over the top. I mean, what I do is I monitor all sources, even those that have problems, just to see what there is out there. And
right.
they sometimes have some real hard stuff, but you have to go back to their original source to determine that. I mean, so I'm always careful about the sources I use, but I monitor them all. And I have to say, they're apparently, and I'm not completely sure about how this works, but they seem to be associated with Lyndon LaRouche. So I have some real concerns about using their stuff. On the other hand, I do know that they use some very extensive intelligence gathering operations. So it's something you look at, and then you got to go back to their own source to make sure it's completely credible.
Well, Greg, I really thank you for coming on the show here and giving us a fill-in on what's going on in Canada. Because
I'll do even better. I'll come out and see you.
That would be great.
Probably in March, I'm going to shoot up to Toronto and see if I can make some trouble.
Good evening. And while we're here, Video Dave, since so much of your segment involves the Internet and the piece that you're going to be talking is on the net, I guess we should thank Sleeper for the tremendous job he's been doing on the website.
Excellent website.
Excellent, fantastic.
He's doing an incredible job.
Isn't
exemplary work.
Yes, and we have, for all you fans at home, mojoradio.com. You go to colkandagger.ca, and we have the public forum up and running. And spies are joining in and talking and putting their posts about what's going on. And thanks to Sleeper for getting that going. It's just tremendous.
Yes,
Levy, I would add that I think we should emphasize the word play. I think Sleeper does a good job because he doesn't treat it as a job.
Okay, good.
Good
point. But whose segment is this, guys?
It's yours. Take it away, my brother.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, I want to talk about ammo for the InfraWarrior. Now, this is produced by a group of subculture types called the Guerrilla News Network. Now, the Guerrilla News Network is an underground alternative news source.
Refuse and Resist is their motto. And the ammo for the Emperor Warrior is a Sundance Film Festival winning documentary that provides music with a message, similar to what the rap group The Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy did in the early 90s, before being shut down by the government, of course. Now, in these days of mass media, which is controlled by the very few alternative voices, which are limited to, of course, underground radio and alternative press, the GNN provides a peek behind the curtain of media cover-ups and whitewashing, exposing people to important global issues via guerrilla programming on the web and television. I think it would be important to go to the clip, having said that.
Okay, the clip, where do we find the clip if you're sitting at home on the Internet, Dave?
Right on the front page there. Yeah, you just log on to our website, and you'll see it there, and you can click it. If you have a real player or...
What do I look for?
Well, we can click...
It says watch a clip, Henry Kissinger. We don't do that one, right? Although that's a great one. After the show, folks, watch the Henry Kissinger backstage clip.
Well, you're looking at the computer now, Lenny, so tell them how to do it. Go to Mojo.
Yeah, Mojo. Leave them there.
On the right side of the screen,
hit the
Nader clip.
Yeah, hit the... No, first of all, what Deep Throat's talking about is when you go to mojoradio.com, the link button, which Sleeper did, which is a great link button, it's got the Twin Towers, the explosion, it's got the Spy Babe, and it's got Mojo, the whole Cloak and Dagger thing.
On the right side of the screen.
Right-hand side of the column, down by the bottom right. And that takes you into cloakanddagger.ca site, and it's talk radio for spies, and you've got Listen Live and Meet the Spies and the Top 10 Conspiracies.
Right.
But right in the middle of that main page, you'll see Info Warrior Ralph Nader.
Exactly.
Exactly, and that's what we're gonna hear.
So now we're going to hear it. You won't see the clip, you'll hear the clip, but it's a fine clip.
It's a doozy.
Roll the clip.
Now look at your late evening news, if you can bear it. Look at it. It's 30 minutes, 9 minutes of ads, 3 minutes of street crime right at the beginning, never corporate crime, very superficially covered, 1 minute of impromptu chit-chat between the anchors, 4 minutes of weather, 4 minutes of sports, and that's what happened in your town tonight? And we own the public airways. The disgrace. It's time to have a home. Television station, radio station, and cable channel. But we own the public airways has been surrendered to the most myopic and avaricious corporation. It is time for a change. The system is not working.
All right.
Terrific.
Video Dave, great clip. Tell me, you have some questions.
Well, my first question goes to Bob Dobbs. Are you there with me, Bob?
Yes, Dave.
Listen, the philosophy of using music as a layer of reinforcement in order to enhance a message, and of course, in the case of Ammo for the Warrior in the clip we just heard, I find it shares a conceptual similarity to your Bob's Media Ecology CD. And I have to ask you, are they stealing your ideas, or is this an homage to your vision?
No, the producer of this show made that album. I had nothing to do with those CDs.
Okay, but you see the similarity I'm trying to...
Yes, okay. And music is the true great drug today. It's not in the sense of Beethoven aesthetic appreciation anymore. Music is the drug, and you are working for the Android meme if you overlay music in what you're doing. You're moving away from silence. Now, I would address Ralph Nader. Incredible naivety there. He thinks that the media, local news, is for local people. He's missing the point. The reason it's irrelevant to humans is not for local people. It's for other media.
Well, Bob, his message should have attracted millions of voters. What's the significance of this clip on why wasn't his message heard?
Because it's totally erroneous. He thinks the media is talking to people, and he thinks it should be directed to him, but he forgets or doesn't know that media is talking to each other and not to people. That's why he never is going to win.
Well, Bob, one of the things that I like about the clip is that it does show the homogenization of culture, which is an effect of the technological matrix, which is what you're talking about.
If I was running for president, which I will probably do someday, I would talk about what I'm saying here, which may appear to be incomprehensible, but the vote, the response to me laying out the reality we live in will create great response, and I would sweep into the White House.
Wow,
Vote for Bob.
Wow.
And that right now, Video Dave, before we go to break, I'm sure you have a new pop culture tip-off, something we don't know.
I sure do, and this one's straight off the wire, of course, as always, and there's a little bit of a personal angle to this, too, and I'm just going to recite to you exactly how I feel regarding what I'm going to tell you. Now, rumblings are starting to emerge again about a forthcoming big-budget remake of the classic Yul Brynner film, Westworld. The cast will include Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, and Sylvester Stallone. These are the current proprietors, as we all know, of the failing Planet Hollywood food chain. Now, it looks like another fine example of how any film in the Hollywood system is vulnerable to be remade, and nothing is sacred at all in the system. What next? A remake of Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Citizen Kane? It's pathetic, gentlemen.
Well, the thing is that Bob said everything's basically disappeared, and so they have to take everything that has been in the past and just remake it, because there's nothing new.
It has nothing to do with the artistic process. The art gets tossed out the window every single time for the sake of commerce. It's sad.
I share your dissing.
Well, I feel strongly about it, gentlemen, so I thought I would reiterate that to you.
Well, you take the slang term to diss somebody, I think that's a popular response to the fact that everything is not information, it's post-information or disinformation, and the youth culture picked up on that.
Welcome, Eric. It's great to be here once again. Everybody who wants to know anything about Eric can go to cloakanddagger.ca, and we've got the links up, and you can read all about him while you're listening to him. It's a double-sensory show, multi-sensory show.
That's right. Eric John Phelps, author of The Vatican Assassins, what do you have for us this week?
We had talked earlier in the day about discussing the Titanic and the Federal Reserve Bank and the Second 30 Years' War.
Yes, Eric. Let's go into a couple of things. We were going to cover tonight... the Titanic is a great story. I think that before we get to it, though, I think what we'd like to do is just hear a little bit more about 9/11 and your research and your links to it and what's happening with it.
Okay. One of the foremost gentlemen I use is Michael Rupert on his VCIA.com. He's got a very good site on that. And also I use Spectrum Magazine with some of their articles. But I'm convinced that the World Trade Center was built to be brought down, just as the Titanic was built to be sunk. And what brought it down was not only internal explosions, but evidently a huge explosion below the buildings that converted the bottom of it into molten steel, and the edifices absorbed the shock, which converted them to dust and rubble. And therefore, that ultimately means that it was an inside job carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency.
Now, before you move a little bit on and we pick this back up, Bob, this fits in, of course, with Eric comes from the Secret Society journalist, observer of the Jesuits, an observer of them, and has done a lot of work studying about the Jesuits, and that links in with the work that we've been doing and talking about on the show with the different secret societies that you identify, the Jesuits, the Bolsheviks, the Zionists, the Nazis, and the Freemasons. So we're sort of concentrating this one office, so to speak, with Eric at this time. And do you want to just set some more introduction to it, and then Eric can go...
Sure. I cover that in my book, Vatican Assassins, Wounded in the House of My Friends, and it can be ordered at 877-280-2866 at Pacific Standard Time. And what I cover in that is the history of the Jesuit order from its inception since 1540 up to the present day, specifically the Kennedy assassination, how I show that through Cardinal Spellman, who was trained by the Jesuits to support him at the American College in Rome, how they carried out the Kennedy assassination using the Knights of Malta. And that same power structure that killed President Kennedy is in effect today and carried out the demolition of the World Trade Center, justifying now this papal crusade in the Middle East against the Muslim people.
Now, Eric, one of the things that I said to you today that is interesting is we were talking about the current Antifada and how it very much began when Sharon started to go with his men up to the Temple Mount. Could you give us some sort of a scenario and idea about where that fits in with the whole group that you're observing, the Jesuits?
Sure. We have to remember that the Masonic Jewish Zionists, whom the papacy has put above the nation of Israel, are the mortal enemies of the Jewish people, the lords below the Jewish people that live there. So the Masonic Jewish Zionists are not the friends of the Jewish people. They worked for the Pope. They were put in office by the Pope. They participated with the Nazis in killing millions of Jews in Europe. It was Masonic Jewish Zionists who were used by the Pope and the SS to round up Jews out of Berlin and completely send them off to Auschwitz. So the Masonic Jewish Zionists and the Jesuits have worked together since World War II. So now they're in control of the nation of Israel. The Jewish people are captive to them. They have no form of self-government there. Both the Likud Party and the Labor Party are under their control. And the purpose for the Masonic Jewish Zionists is to get rid of the Dome of the Rock and the Alaska Mosque and the temple site, and then to rebuild Solomon's Temple, ultimately for the Pope. And one of the greatest evidences of this is that Shimon Peres deeded the old city of Jerusalem to the Pope in 1993.
Yeah, can you go through that now and give us a little idea of how that was done and how that was arranged?
Barry Chemish has all that information. You can access that on his website. And also Joel Bannerman, they provided that information for me. They showed me how it was reported in an Italian newspaper, I believe it was called La Fada, something like that, that in 1993 that indeed Shimon Peres and Yossi Belin deeded the old city, and particularly the Temple Mount, to the papacy. So that is a done deal, and the UN has a special treaty with the city of Jerusalem, apart from the nation of Israel, and that was accomplished in the 80s.
Now, what's interesting, Eric, is that on Friday, October the 4th, in The Guardian, there was a headline, and I quote, the headline is, Al-Aqsa Mosque May Collapse. And it basically reads, and I quote The Guardian, Ariel Sharon risks provoking another Palestinian backlash over control of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem as he decides in the coming days what to do about a large and unstable bulge in a wall of one of Islam's holiest sites. It goes on to say that The Guardian goes on to say archaeologists have warned the Prime Minister that without urgent repairs, the Mount's southern wall and buildings attached to it, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque, could collapse on some of the hundreds of thousands of Muslim worshippers who are expected to visit during Ramadan, which begins next month, unquote. And The Guardian goes on. I'm just wondering how you see this story in light of what you've been watching and observing over the last quite a while.
Well, I have no doubt that the Alaska Mosque and the Dome of the Rock will come down. How it's going to happen, I'm not sure. We must not forget that the Masonic Jewish Zionists that are running Israel are partners with people like the head of the PLO, Yasser Arafat. In fact, Shimon Peres and Yasser Arafat have stocks in the same telephone company, Paltel, in Israel. So they are friends and they work together. They both make pilgrimages to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City, which is overseen by the Archbishop of New York, Edward Cardinal Egan. So they're on the same team. The Masonic Muslim leaders of the East there and the Masonic Jewish Zionists are working together for the destruction of both of those mosques for the purpose of rebuilding that temple. Alan Greenspan is another high-level Masonic Jewish Freemason. He was knighted, I believe, by the Queen of England, if that's correct. I know he received some English knighthood. But we must remember that the papacy has controlled the English dynasty or the English throne since King George III. And is still in control of it this day. So whatever is done to the English royal house is done ultimately by the Black Pope. So Alan Greenspan is merely his agent,
right,
on the Board of Governors to oversee what goes on with the board. And the most powerful bank of the Federal Reserve System is the New York Bank. And heading that is an Irish Roman Catholic who was Jesuit trained, and his name is William J. McDonough.
Now, we have the Queen here in Canada. When she goes to visit the Pope, she wears black.
Yes, she does.
As a form of, what was that?
Subordination.
Lenny, I have a question for Eric. I've looked at your book. Why do you believe what you read, the quotes, the historical research? Why do you believe the information there? And the follow-up is, if the Vatican lost its control, how would the world be different? Whatever you're afraid of here, how would it be different if that control disappeared, the world?
Okay, your first question is, why do I believe the quotes that I quote?
Yes.
Which specific quotes are you referring to?
I say any of them. Why do you believe the Italian newspaper when they made that story you said in the previous segment? Why do you believe anything you read?
Well, there is a chain of evidence over some 350 years.
Key word here, evidence,
established.
Bob.
Well, that's evidence that you weren't there at those activities. You're reading reports.
Well, that's one of the things of history. We have to consult the primary sources, so we try to find the authors that were there at the time the history was taking place.
Well, couldn't that have been distorted since there's so much deception going on?
It could be, but when you have a chain of evidence and a series of events that all tie together, then no, you don't.
All right, let me tell you something. I was personally involved in the Kennedy assassination, and I know that the Vatican was not involved. Now,
how do you know that?
I didn't. I was involved in the Kennedy assassination.
What part did you play in the Kennedy assassination?
I helped organize and plan it, and then I helped cover it up.
Was the Central Intelligence Agency involved in that?
No.
Yes,
no three-letter soup institutions. It was a group of individuals.
No, the Central Intelligence Agency was involved, according to Mark Lane. It was proven in the court.
Yes, if you're talking to somebody who knows more than Mark Lane or anybody, I was involved.
What about Victor Marchetti's limited hangout that he talked about?
That was the fact that I was involved, and I'm telling you that I know who did it.
Okay, so you're saying the Central Intelligence Agency was not involved?
No.
That's not true.
No institutions were involved. It
That's
was individuals. They might have been employed in some function in the CIA or the military or whatever, but they did not operate completely in that function. So you're talking to someone who was there, involved in the planning, and what do you say to that? Are you going to listen to me?
I'm saying you're wrong. I'm saying...
Well, why are you saying I'm wrong? I was involved in it.
If you're saying the Central Intelligence...
I'm stating my guilt.
May I respond
working
to you?
For Bob?
I was working for a group of people, historical.
Which historical people?
I won't say.
Why not?
Why not?
Because it's dangerous.
Of course it's dangerous, but these are dangerous times, and it's time that men come out and tell what they know.
That's right. We're all in this together, Bob. We need to know what you know. We all need to know everything all the time.
Yes, but the main conspiracy is that you can't know what's going on because you're only getting it through secondary sources.
Yes, you can. When I establish the track record of the Jesuit order and bring them into the power and influence they have in this country today, I can't establish who did it.
Well, why do you go on sources that you read? Why would anybody, as we and our group that did this, use any written memos or any kind of information? We wouldn't leave a trail. If we did, it would be misleading.
Well,
there's a whole chain of evidence that the Knights of Malta were involved in virtually every aspect of that assassination. You have Carter DeLoach.
The chain of evidence? First of all, you weren't there. I'm telling you that I was there.
You weren't there? If you weren't there and you can't know history,
I was there.
Take all the history books and throw them away.
That's what I say. I tell you, throw away the books.
I tell you.
Yep. Let's hold on here, Bob. I mean, everybody.
Let's have people call in and tell us what they say.
In fact, we have a call right now. Let's go over to Bill. Bill, thank you for holding.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether, the current Pope John Paul II has any involvement in all this.
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Of course.
He's a black pope?
Pardon me?
Okay, he said he was mentioning the black pope.
The black pope, no. Peter Hans Kolbenbach, controls Pope John Paul II.
The black pope, so there's a pope behind the pope.
He's the Jesuit general, yes.
So basically all of Roman Catholicism is a farce, and the church itself.
That's correct. This doctrine is not biblical, and it is a political and financial power clothed with a religious garb. And that garb is controlled by the Jesuit general.
Eric?
Yes.
The question about the effect that would have had on human history that Bob had asked, the Bolshevik, the connection between the Bolshevik Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, Hitler, Stalin, etc., and of course we know all about Project Paperclip and the connection the Vatican had in moving Nazis to South America. Can you go into a little bit about that? Because I think that there's some really good connections there that show the effect that these groups have had.
Okay, well, we have the sinking of the Titanic, the getting rid of Astor out of the way. So
now, the sinking of the Titanic was a very watertight cover-up, is what you're saying.
Correct.
1912.
Then we have the, and by the way, they were building the Panama Canal, preparing it for the beginning of the Second 30 Years' War, which was completed in 1914. So we have the beginning then of the Second 30 Years' War from 1914 to 1945, and during that epoch of time, we have all these various revolutions that the Jesuits were behind, including World War I, which was punishment to Germany for the victory of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. Then we have the Bolshevik Revolution ending in 1922, that five-year civil war. Then we had the bringing of Stalin to power, who was taught by Jesuits at Tiflis Seminary in Georgia. Then we have the Mexican Civil War that resulted in the murder of a million Mexicans from about 1910 to 1920, around that era. We have the Spanish Civil War that resulted in 600,000 Spanish being killed, and they were Roman Catholic liberals who wanted to be free from the papacy. They had expelled the Jesuits in 1932 from Spain. They brought Franco to power and brought in 4 million Muslim troopers to persecute them. Then we have the World War II, which begins in 1933, actually 1939 to 1945. So that whole epoch of time is nothing but Jesuit vengeance on the nations that had suppressed them during the 19th century, ultimately coming and bringing us into the Cold War, which lasted another 45 years. So without the 19th century suppressions of the Jesuit order out of Europe, we would have not had all those revolutions that plagued the 20th century in mass murder.
Thank you for that. Now we're going to go over to a phone call. We have Ad Absurdum from Toronto. A.A., welcome to the show.
Hello there. How do you do?
Hello.
Hello. Well, it's Ad Absurdum, actually, but I was wondering, I wanted to ask Bob a question, if I could, about what just happened before the commercial break, that perhaps if he could explain in terms of his media ecology or the media effects, why it is that people are more than willing to believe secondary sources about things they don't know anything about, but that when a primary source comes along and says, I was involved, they don't know what to do, let alone believe what they're saying.
Very good point. And that's what I was trying to show. And this is... Did you miss a bit, Pete Throat?
Nope, everybody's fine.
I heard the sound. Okay, very good point, caller. The thing is that how do we establish the original fact in this multimedia simulation that we live in? Here I am telling Eric that I was involved. He first cites other sources. Then he has to deal with the fact I'm saying it. Now, once I say it, what are we going to do with that fact? What are we going to do with me? Because I could deny it if push comes to shove. That's the problem with communication.
Oh, you mean you could say, if Siri came to your door now and said, you helped kill Kennedy, you could say, no, I didn't, I just said that.
Yeah, I was just being metaphorical.
Well, you're being a wonderful rhetorical device is what you're doing.
Yes, and I may have been involved in the Kennedy assassination. The point is, how are we going to deal with any of this stuff and this communication confusion?
Well, we'll go on the internet and look at your picture and go, oh, he's too young to have done that.
Oh, but we know I look young because of the D-cell. The water
and the D-cell we're going to talk about next week. We're going to talk about how you stay so young. For an 80-year-old guy, you look good, Bob.
Yes. Now, the D-cell was a cover-up, too. That was a big scandal conspiracy, the suppression of that. But
you can always say everything totally is hearsay if you really want to, but that doesn't make the patterns go away.
We're all human beings, and all we have is the information we can find and try to take all the sources we can, try to find them. As Alex Jones often said, don't listen to me. Just don't have to believe me. You don't know me. I'm just a voice on the radio. But wake up and go out there and look.
But see, throat.
Yes.
Here's the point, is that if we establish whoever did it, about the JFK assassination, the next day the media must continue with new content. It's the medium's need, voracious need for data, that annuls all conclusions, temporary, and any story. That's the conspiracy, the information overload. I think it's way bigger than any Vatican control or something, or any particular control. This endless need for information has destroyed any human scale in our life.
Well, we may have a question.
CNN.
We may have a question that actually applies to that. We have a couple of more emails. We'll go turn this one over to our Agent O.
Hey, Bob. This one's from Ulster 123 in Denmark. His question is in regards to the JFK assassination, and it seems that Americans don't like to question who's president. If Bush died suspiciously, do you think they would think different?
No, it doesn't matter how the citizen thinks, because they have to confront and deal with and respond to and adapt to whatever the information environment is imposing on them.
Well, I want to know, I want to go back to Titanic, and just because that is a terrific conspiracy cover-up that has been watertight, and just to get into the means, motive, and opportunity around that whole thing before we leave Eric go tonight.
Yeah, Mr. Astor dies.
Correct.
All right, yes, Eric, a little, if you'd like to take on the JFK, Do Americans Care, or do the Titanic, whatever's your fancy right now.
Maybe he's way more important than Mr. Astor.
Pardon me?
Explain the importance of Mr. Astor, who dies on the Titanic.
Mr. Astor was the wealthiest man in the world, apart from the Pope. He was a high-level Jewish Freemason who resisted the establishment of the Federal Reserve Act with his friend and Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis.
And Guggenheim dies on the boat, too.
Guggenheim dies, and also Isidore Strauss, the president of
Macy's. Now, this obviously is starting to flesh out and take shape, and there's something more than just hearsay going on here, and it's a lot more than just coincidence.
Right. There's a good book out called The Titanic Conspiracy that was released about 20 years ago.
And it showed written by?
I have it on my shelf here. It shows that 50 people... Hold just one second.
This is live radio.
This is live radio. That's the way it's
going to be. We're going to take our break in just a couple of minutes here because we have to get to the bottom of this. This is exciting.
It's written by Robin Gardner and Dan Van Der Vat.
And publisher?
And the publisher is a Birch Lane Press book. And it was published in 1995 by Robin Gardner, Dan Van Der Vat.
We will add this to our links on our podcast.
And so let's go ahead with the conspiracy about the Titanic.
And in this book, it shows that over 50 people canceled their reservations at the last minute before Titanic departed, and one of them was J.P. Morgan, who had a suite on the Titanic.
And there was also a cardinal that was moving around, right?
It was a Jesuit provincial. He was Francis M. Brown. He was the most powerful man in Ireland and Australia, because the Irish province includes Ireland and Australia. He was on the ship for a day and a night and a day, taking pictures of the wealthy first-class passengers, and right before the Titanic departed Queenstown to the North Atlantic, the lucky priest, quote-unquote, departed. And you can see this in Secrets of the Titanic, put out by National Geographic. And the man who narrated that was Martin Sheen, who is very intimate with the Jesuit order. In fact, I have a picture of him over with some Jesuit novitiate not far from me, posing with some Jesuits.
Oh, that's amazing. And we'll have you back.
On the web.
That's right. We want to have you back to talk more about that. And, of course, maybe Bob Dobbs can talk to the people of Hollywood, his connections there, and get you to remake the Titanic, because I think that needs a rewrite. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Eric John Phelps.
Terrific, Eric. Thanks a lot for coming, and we'll hear you again soon.
Okay.
George.
Oh, hi, I'd like to bring a point up with your host there, Mr. Dobbs. If he was involved in the Kennedy assassination, then I'm sure he's familiar with a woman named Madeline Duncan Brown. She was Lyndon Johnson's mistress. She confessed before she died last year, and the works have been published in a book called The Elite Serial Killers by Galen Ross. Seemingly there were 44 people that met the day before Kennedy was assassinated to discuss the finer points of the assassination. 25 of the main conspirators had a private meeting upstairs. She was in the house when it happened. Some of the people involved, of course, were Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover and his chauffeur, and John J. McCloy. And I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised the junior G-man of the CIA at the day, Mr. George Bush, might have been there also, although I don't know that for a fact. This was on a radio show in San Francisco, the Dr. Stan Monteith show, which is at Liberty, RadioLiberty.com, so it can probably be archived for your listeners if they want to hear the show over. But
all right, well, let's check in with Bob Dobbs here. Bob, do you have a comment on, I don't know what's more amazing, that the MDB claimed to have done this or known about this, or that, you know, anybody would cheat on Lady Bird. I mean, she was such a nice lady. What do you have to say, Bob?
Well, George, it's a good point. The thing is, George, many people in the government, in the higher, more authoritative positions in United States society, knew that the Kennedy was being assassinated. They didn't. They weren't involved, but they knew. Just like most intelligence agencies knew about September 11th before it happened. Now, the people who did it are above those levels. And there are ways that somebody can suppose from certain actions that those people, if you're near them, are doing something. But LBJ was not involved in the assassination, but he knew it was going to happen. And the point is that these people in those positions, institutional power, could not control the people who wanted to do it. It was a necessary action because of other reasons, just like September 11th happened for other reasons. So you follow what I'm saying is that the level of power that accomplishes these things, where they program the whole human history, the whole environment from 1963 on, is something that most people don't have access to.
All right, we have one final question from our spy babe, and then we're going to turn things over to Lenny. Spy babe, you have a comment sent in here.
First of all, I would like to thank Kensington Cat for his love note, and he wants to know, can Lenny comment on the bulge in the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
Yeah, I certainly can. I think that the pattern of news that we're hearing from the different groups that we've been in touch with over the last few years has been talking a lot about this and has been predicting this. And over the years, there's been a number of underground tunnel operations by various authorities within Israel. And it's alleged now that this digging underneath the Dome of the Rock has caused this weakening. Whether or not it has or hasn't is in some ways irrelevant. The thing is that there are moves by officials within the Israeli government to show that they're interest. There's interest in the Temple Mount, and the plan that the various secret societies all seem to agree upon is the rebuilding of the temple and the starting again of daily sacrifices. And this is something that's been echoing in the background over the years, more and more, and getting louder and louder as time goes on.
Oh, good evening, everybody.
Good evening. How are you doing? And congratulations on getting the public forum up.
Well, it's been a big success. I thought I'd even mention some of the names of the big contributors so people can hear their names on the web. And
first of all, we should tell people, yes, www.mojoradio.com. Click on Cloak and Dagger on the right-hand side of the screen. And right now in the middle, kind of top middle of the screen, you'll see public forum. All right, Sleeper, who's up there?
Well, Inferior Pirated Copy put up a couple posts during the show, so that'll be good for your our guys to go home and check out tonight. Kensington Cat, I guess, tried to make a connection with the Spy Babe. That's a good to see them using all the mediums. And Shadow, Ithacan Sand, Paranoia, Tom Rai, Soup Daddy. I mean, there's some pretty sharp people out there.
Yes, I've been reading the forum. It's terrific, and anyone can dial up and get into cloakanddagger.ca and share their thoughts with us. And, of course, if we didn't get to some of the questions, because we had a few more coming in over the Internet, you can always post them there, and everybody talks to everybody.
That's a swell idea.
Yeah, and when you go to the site, what I like about it is you can go to the secret links. And within the links, you can go to the media news. And at the media news, we have a lot of different interesting archival material. One of my favorite is the ad from the New York Times, which was taken out by the Admiral of the Pentagon, Admiral Moore, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Benton Parton, who was a joint member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And
these are big names, big names.
Big guys who took out an ad in the New York Times and spent $50,000 doing it. And the ad talked about how TWA was shot down by two missiles, and the National Transportation Board were covering it up. So when Bob talks about how do you know, this is how sometimes it's possible to know when you see people within the government taking out these big, big page ads.
And they have nothing to gain from it.
And they have nothing to gain from it, and they put their necks on the line.
Yes, but wait a minute, Lenny. LBJ knows that Kennedy's going to be assassinated, and he's powerless to stop it. Patton and them were powerless to do anything. Let's understand the power of those that I'm part of and what we're talking about. You can know, everybody can know, but you can't stop us.
Well, Operation Mockingbird was the CIA's plan to infiltrate America's newsrooms, and it was such a success that former CIA Director Colby boasted, and I have his quote here. He said, quote, "The Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any major significance in the major media," unquote.
Yes, but I own the CIA.
And though officials have admitted to planting fabrications, they still planted, and they've admitted to planting fabrications in the past in the press, they're no doubt still at it. And one of the greatest fabrications is the story of 9/11, and especially the story about the terrorist passport surviving the fiery crash into the World Trade Center. I mean, what could that be but government-issued pablum?
Bob, I'm going to put what you're talking about to the test, because the site itself is Sleeper's swan song, the last great work of a web artist. And I'm going to be archiving the works of Bob and Connie Dobbs and the Cloak and Dagger Show, and we're going to see if that will make a difference.
Okay.
Whether it exists.
Speaking of which, we have to go now. But Bob, next week's show,
next week's
show. You want to plug next week's show?
Yeah, next week is a big show because we're going to bring back the conspiracies to homegrown. We're going to show the conspiracies between the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario, the collusion with the drug industry, and the Sugar Institute, and talk about a live doctor whose license got pulled by the college and was kicked out of the province, and a real healer at that.
All right. Bob, the last word is for you.
Eat medicine.